Welcome to the Dinner Party Download. This is your icebreaker.
All right, here's a joke. What's the difference between a folk singer and a pepperoni pizza? A pepperoni pizza can feed a family of five.
I'm Rico Galliano.
I'm Brendan Francis Noonan, and from APM, American Public Media, this is the Dinner Party Download, the culture show that helps you win your dinner party.
You just got a joke from folk singer and storyteller Todd Snyder. That'll help break the ice. We started the show with that joke because A, it makes us laugh, and B, it is about food.
And so is the rest of the show. It's our annual post-Thanksgiving all-food episode.
Yay.
Featuring some of our favorite conversations about food from past shows. We imagine you all listening as you construct sky-high sandwiches out of your Thanksgiving leftovers.
And then we imagine you sharing some with us, and then we all watch football together.
Except me.
Except Brendan. It's nice for me anyway. Coming up, we will hear from food writer extraordinaire Michael Pollan. Also, etiquette advice from chef and PBS host Lydia Bastianich.
But first, as at any dinner party, we start with small talk. Here's one of our favorite mini conversations with regular guest Richard Lawson, who, by the way, was named VanityFair.com's Hollywood columnist this week.
Good going.
He gave us small talk about some big food.
Richard, what story are you going to be talking about at your dinner parties this weekend?
I will be talking about a new jalapeno pepper that was scientifically created so we can have bigger jalapeno poppers. Yeah.
For those who don't know, a popper, that's like a cheese-stuffed jalapeno.
Yeah, it's stuffed with cheese and then deep-fried. It's really good for you. And now that we can have them even bigger.
Doctors recommend one a day.
Right.
They're like the centrum of the fast food world.
Yeah, and they called it the Jalmundo, so it's kind of a portmanteau between, you know, jalapeno and mundo.
Doesn't mundo mean world?
Well, that's what I thought.
So it's like the jalapeno earth, like earth-sized jalapeno.
My question is it still a popper when you have to wedge it into your mouth?
Yeah, it's like jumbo popcorn shrimp or something. I'm not sure why.
It sounds like an entree.
Exactly. You have to cut it with a knife and fork.
That's fascinating. Do we have any idea how they did it? Did they like feed it rats so it would grow?
They bred a regular sized jalapeno popper with bell pepper. So I guess maybe it's less spicy too, which could be good if you're eating that much.
Now all they need to do is cross like an antacid tablet with a frisbee. And
exactly. And we'll just sort of gnaw on it during your meal.
Richard, thank you so much for the small talk.
Thank you.
And now, time for cocktails.
Once again, we tell you something that happened in history, then give you a fitting drink to serve along with it.
It's like history is a bottle of olive oil, except instead of oil, it is full of booze.
So it's basically a fifth of liquor.
Well, yeah, but the liquor is in an olive oil bottle to keep with the food episode theme.
I think liquor's food already.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, here's the history. Back in 1801, the people of Cheshire, Massachusetts, cooked up one of the oddest political gifts ever.
Michelle Phillippe tells the story.
Thomas Jefferson's biggest fans were cheesemakers. Specifically, Baptists in the cheesemaking town of Cheshire, Massachusetts. See, in New England, Baptists were a tiny minority with no political power. So Jefferson's belief that church and state should be separate sounded great to them. In fact, when Jefferson won the presidency, the Cheshire Baptists were so elated they decided to make their hero a gift. In July 1801, they began work on a gigantic wheel of cheese. 4 feet tall, 15 inches thick, the thing weighed over 1,200 pounds. It was too heavy for a wagon, so they had to wait till winter to haul it to Washington, D.C. on a sled. And when it arrived on New Year's Day, Jefferson called it, quote,
"the greatest cheese that was ever put to press."
It wasn't the greatest for long, though. 30 years later, a New Yorker bestowed a 1,400-pound cheese upon President Andrew Jackson, who set it up in the White House and invited the general public to come eat it. It was gone in 2 hours.
So that was the history lesson. Now it's time for the booze. I'm on the line.
The booze!
That's the spirit. I'm on the line with Nancy Thomas. She is the owner and founder of Metze Bistro and Bar in the Berkshires, in a town about 15 miles up from Cheshire. Nancy, you've heard the history. What cocktail did you create? And I hope there's no cheese in it.
There's no cheese in it, but it'll go really well with cheese.
Oh, I'm intrigued. Tell me more.
Well, so we created a cocktail which we decided to name the Berkshire Local Motive.
The local motive. Is that because they put did they put the cheese on a train at any point? Or I think
they
were
they didn't. They actually were very cautionary to the handling of the cheese and put it on a sled, yeah.
Okay.
So we started our cocktail in a shaker glass with a local product, Berkshire Mountain Bourbon.
Oh.
It's a distillery here in Berkshire County.
That is the reason we're calling it the local motive.
That's the local motive. We're big advocates of small agriculture and that Jeffersonian spirit of the small farm.
Yes.
We added 1 ounce of an aged apple brandy. As you know, the cheese was actually made in a cider press.
I didn't know that, but now I do.
And then we added 1/4 ounce of maple syrup, a couple of dashes of Peychaud's Bitters, which is an American bitters, over ice, and give it a good stir until it's well chilled. And then we like to use a little vintage cocktail glass, which I call a coupe, which is like a martini-style glass, but the old-fashioned ones, and add to the top of it a little sparkling cider.
That sounds delightful. So this is a smaller martini glass?
It's a smaller martini glass, like you might imagine in the 50s or something, that little coupe glass.
Yeah, do you think that's appropriate for such a big item that we're celebrating?
Well, I think the cheese can be mammoth, but I think we have to be cautionary when drinking lots of hard liquor.
Nice, tasty-sounding drink. But Brendan, it's a little sad. All that amazing effort went into making and delivering this giant cheese, right? And today you would just order it from like the Harry and David catalog.
Yeah. Well, I think some of their gift towers actually do weigh 1,600 pounds. So the tradition lives on.
Yeah.
Folks, you can find our cocktails at dinnerpartydownload.org.
They go great with enormous crackers.
And now it's time for the first of several main courses on this all-food episode. The main course being the part of our show where we usually head out into the world to sample tasty new things. Mm. But a while back, Rico, you dined old school style.
That is right. I met up with Peter Maruzzi. He calls himself a nightlife historian. And he's put together several books about life and design in the early to mid-20th century. His latest is called Classic Dining, and it is all about the remaining handful of upscale restaurants from that era. These are the kind of places where they prepare steak Diane and Caesar salads at your table.
Wow, Diane and Caesar are still together.
They live on in these places.
After all these years.
So when it came to picking a place to interview Peter in L.A., the choice was obvious.
We are in Musso and Frank's Grill, one of the oldest restaurants, if not the oldest restaurant in Hollywood. And it has everything you want in a classic restaurant. Dark wood walls, beautiful vinyl booths, red vinyl booths, great big bar with bartenders who know how to make great cocktails. It has an exhibition grill.
What does that mean?
Meaning that you can actually see them cook the meat as opposed to them doing it in the back kitchen. And they use charcoal instead of gas. Charcoal broiled. Tastes so much better. You've got to have charcoal.
Oh, and our drinks have arrived, which are?
Gin martini with 2 olives. And then they serve it with a little carafe of extra martini that you can then pour into your glass when you finish drinking.
And I should note that I'm also having a martini, making this the first actual martini lunch that I've ever taken while on the job. Cheers. So we also have the waiters wearing red vests. A lot of them feel like they've worked here since it opened. There's some incredible toupees on them. What is it about places like this that first appealed to you?
Well, I just think that they harken back to an earlier era and that it is so hard now, unfortunately, in America to find places like this because there are so many contemporary restaurants that have, you know, the hard surfaces and it's very loud and they have, you know, they have young waiters that are excellent, but this is part of American history. This is the way people used to eat and drink and spend the whole night. It's wonderful. I mean, it's just like people who appreciate old movies or old architecture. It's honoring our past and also experiencing the fun of that era.
You went around the country visiting places like this. First of all, what do you think is your favorite spot?
Well, overall, New Orleans is probably the best. I mean, I love New York, and I love they have, you know, great steakhouses, but I just love New Orleans. The restaurants are most of them from the 19th century, and they're in these old buildings, and you know, they have weird cocktails and things that, you know, catch on fire. And
what's a good example?
You know, I once had something called Café Brûlot, which they serve after dinner in New Orleans at Galatoire's, a really great old restaurant. So in the punch bowl is coffee, and then there's like cinnamon sticks floating, and then the captain comes to your table, and he has a big pitcher of brandy, and he holds it way up high, and he pours it, and then he sets it on fire and pours this flaming brandy into the punch bowl of coffee.
Just like a flamethrower made of alcohol.
Yeah, exactly. And you got to be careful it doesn't splash in you. So you start drinking it like it's a regular cup of coffee because you don't really taste the brandy. And then you go outside and you're just plastered. It's unbelievable how strong this thing is.
Sunlight hurts at that point.
Yeah, it's just something else.
So the kind of food they serve at these kind of restaurants, is there a name for it? Is this a genre of food?
Yeah, traditionally, it's been called continental-style fine dining. And the origins of it are French. French was the high-end cuisine in America for 19th century and most of the 20th century. But it's been Americanized. So really, it's French, but then with American...
Fancy, but made even more decadent.
Yeah, I'd say that's right.
And when does that come about?
Pretty much all of these things that we're talking about really were perfected after World War II because Americans had money. They were excited about going out to eat. These restaurants were competing, and they had to come up with new ideas all the time. And so a lot of these things really were formed and perfected between, let's say, 1945 and 1965.
And maybe also because soldiers had just come back from maybe fighting in some of these places, France, and gotten a taste for it?
True. In fact, you know, a lot of the Polynesian restaurants were popular because a lot of soldiers in World War II had been in the Pacific, and they had started eating unusual things that they wouldn't have found ordinarily. So then the tiki restaurants, the Polynesian restaurants, sort of played off on that.
And our waiter is here. Let's order.
You know, for the lobster thermidor, do you get two halves? Yeah, that sure sounds good. Okay, the lobster thermidor, why not?
It's an excellent choice.
I know.
And I'm going to go with the Welsh rarebit, basically a big bowl of cheese. Thank you. No salads for us. This is old school.
But speaking of historic restaurants, Lowry's the Prime Rib in Beverly Hills on La Cienega was opened in 1938, and they came up with the idea of serving salad before dinner. Up to that point, it was always after dinner.
Was that in America in general? Like, people would not eat salad before dinner?
Yeah, and according to Richard Frank, who's the son of the original co-founder, and he's like 93, he said that it was because in California you could get salad all year long, whereas back east in the Midwest, they only had salad certain times of the year. So it was kind of to show off the fact that California has salad all year long, so they served it right away.
They're like, check this out, lettuce.
Right, in the dead of winter.
That's amazing. But still, when I think of classic restaurants, I think of long, heavy meals, you know?
You're meant to spend time at the meal. There's no rush. You go through, you know, from cocktails to the relish tray to Oysters Rockefeller to, you know, the lobster thermidor, and then you have cognac and Cherry's Jubilee. So, I mean, it's a whole
diet food, I would say.
I mean, I guess if you ate as much as they used to eat at these places back then, yes, you would be heavy, but you'd be smoking and drinking a lot more. So, you know, it's all part of the package.
Who knows what actually killed you? It might have just as well have been the cigars.
Right. I'd rather die for eating too much lobster thermidor than smoking, you know, Camels.
Peter Maruzzi, his latest book is called Classic Dining.
Enrico, I don't know if you remember, but I was there when you returned from that interview.
One stiff martini and a bowl of cheese later.
Yeah, and you didn't get a lot done that afternoon.
I am not cut out to be a madman, is what I found out.
Yeah, you don't see Don Draper asleep under his desk clutching his stomach. At all.
Not often.
Yeah.
They cut that part out.
Didn't see that episode. All right, ladies and gentlemen, lots more to come on this post-Thanksgiving edition of the Dinner Party Download, including chef and TV host Lydia Bastianich telling us about the time she kind of cooked for God.
Some might say, when our dinner party continues.
Welcome back to the Dinner Party Download, the culture show that helps you win your dinner party. I'm Brendan Francis Noonan.
I'm Rico Galliano, and this is our annual post-Thanksgiving all-food episode in which we peel back the tinfoil on some of our favorite segments about food, pop them in the microwave, and serve them piping hot straight into your ears.
That's gross and painful.
Yeah. Sorry, everybody.
But the show isn't. Coming up, we have bao chef Eddie Huang talking about learning to eat American style, and I sample NYC salt. Get it? But first, it's time to take our elbows off the table and learn some etiquette.
Yes, each week you send in your questions about how to behave, and earlier this year they were answered by Chef Lydia Bastianich. She launched her first Italian restaurant in Queens circa 1971. She now runs several around the country, but she's best known as a fixture on public TV cooking shows. When we spoke to her, she was airing a series of PBS specials called Lydia Celebrates America. Before we got to the etiquette questions, we talked to her about her youth in another country.
You know, you're known best as an Italian-American chef, but as a person of Croatian descent, I'd like to point out your town was part of Italy, but became part of Croatia shortly after you were born. Did Croatian cooking influence you at all?
Absolutely. You know, in a border situation, who you are, what you speak. I mean, you know, I now speak five languages, but you're born at least bilingual.
Yeah.
And the food reflects that, reflects the Slavic, the Germanic from the north. So for me to do spetzel, for me to do sauerkraut, for me to do palacinke, the Austro-Hungarian occupation of that area, you know, strudel.
Palacinke was my grandmother's specialty. It's a crepe where you can fill it up with sweet or savory, and it's delicious.
Yes, simple crepe, you know, nice and thin. And, you know, when you have, it's like a painter, you have a palette, a rich palette. The painting can be beautiful.
Are there maybe Croatian analogs to Italian dishes?
Yes. You know pasta e fagioli?
Yes,
beans.
Pasta with beans. Yeah.
Okay. Jota. Jota is beans and sauerkraut. Instead of pasta, we put sauerkraut in there, and that's a very popular soup.
Because cabbage is more prevalent.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's the Slavic influence.
Sounds good. Well, maybe you can whip us up a batch after we ask you.
We're done taping. Weirdly, that's all we have time for. We got to go eat with Lydia.
Well, first, we need to ask you some of the questions our listeners sent in for you.
Unfortunately.
Sure.
They're just getting in the way of the food.
So let's begin with Brett in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Brett writes, I have a family with several less than adventurous eaters. I want to try cooking new foods for them, but the mere thought of using a different component freaks them out. Should I make a dish and lie? Hey, everyone, it's chicken. Make two dishes and let them decide.
One that has chicken and one with another ingredient, for instance.
Yeah. Or let them decide. Just stay traditional and make one dish with the chicken and experiment when I'm alone.
I think you certainly should experiment when you're alone and keep on cooking. But I think that you should be free to move on to different territory, if you will, to add a spice, to add a different vegetables. But I think you should tell them as well. You know, you should say, listen, I love cooking. You know, you're kind of keeping me in a box. We're going to go a little bit out of the box. I hope you like it. And if not, have a plate of simple pasta and butter sauce for them. But, have an little alternative or something for them. But absolutely, you should push the edge. You should not diversify 3-4 new things at once. Choose one thing and add it to the dish.
All but right. it's better. But won't they feel like they're like a child, though? It's like, I just get a plate of pasta. I came over here. I just get butter pasta.
Well,
a little bit. They should feel that way.
Exactly.
You know, he's not ignoring them. But, you know, there's a lesson to be learned here. You got to move on. You got the experiment. You got to taste.
Live a little.
And he's willing to do it for them.
That's nicer than what I would do. I would just give them the phone number of Domino's.
Hit the road. Come on. All right. There's your guidance, Brett in Harrisburg. Here is a little something from Ryan via Facebook. We don't know where he's from. Ryan writes, my wife and I are moving back in with my parents for a few months. My wife has many food intolerances to some very common ingredients. This is quite a list, including garlic, onions, yeast, corn, and almost all Italian seasoning. He says it's difficult for others to make food for my wife, including my very caring mother who enjoys cooking.
Sounds like trouble.
Yeah, he asked, what's a good way to broach the subject of improving his mother's food preparation?
You know, short of running two kitchens, what I would do is actually I would make a list of all the ingredients that your wife cannot eat or is allergic to. And then you just be positive. We're really looking forward to your cooking. The only thing that we ask you to respect is this list.
Mm-hmm.
I think mom will get it.
That's a pretty huge list, though. I mean, garlics and onions, that's
everything. But I noticed the list has lots of Italian ingredients, and not to stereotype, but his name's Ryan, so maybe his mother's Irish, and maybe this won't be
a problem.
Yeah, exactly. Now, if you're dealing with me...
Yeah, you're their worst nightmare.
But I could circumvent it, absolutely.
You're an expert. All right, here's a small question we have, but I think I've thought about this myself. It comes from Robin in New Jersey. Robin asks, is it really that bad to cut your pasta instead of using a large spoon to twirl?
Sacrilegious.
I agree.
I agree.
Can't take it.
You know, you have the short pasta. If you choose short pasta, penne, rigatoni, then you use that pasta.
Sure.
But when you're using spaghetti or linguine, the beauty of it is precisely that, this kind of twirling of this pasta, then it kind of unfurls in your mouth and you begin to bite and it's al dente. Those are all sensations that any pasta lover really wants, the texture, the tactile element.
Absolutely.
And, you know, you start with cutting it up and then you end with making airplane sounds. I mean, Robin, grow up.
Yeah.
Exactly. Then you end up with the spoon eating it up and it's like soup and don't go there.
That's for children.
So I'll just move on to Abigail in Pittsburgh, PA, my hometown. Abigail writes, I am a college freshman, and about once a month, one of my friend's parents will stop by and take us all out to dinner. What's a good way to determine how much my meal should cost? I don't want to be rude and get something incredibly expensive because I'm not paying. But then again, I'm in college and being offered real non-dining hall food for free.
I think that if the parents invite you and they take you to a restaurant, they know the parameters and the expenditures in those restaurants.
Yeah.
So you're within limits. You can order just about anything you feel like having.
Nice.
Don't order two orders of steak or yeah. and then, you know, take one home with you, whatever it may be. But thank them and be grateful and tell them exactly what you said to me, you know. I'm in college and I appreciate a good meal.
Sure. Caviar all the way.
All right. So here's a question that we ask each of our etiquette guests. What's the most memorable get-together you've ever been to? Who, what, where? Details, please.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
I must say, 2 years ago when Pope Benedict came to the United States, I was asked to cook for him.
What?
Yes. So I did a little research. His mother was a chef, so he was very much into food.
Oh,
so I said, you know, I'm going to go and do my thing. So you know what I did? I did goulash. I did spätzles. I did apple strudel. And
his comfort foods from Germany.
Yeah.
He would walk through the house. We would cook. And it was kind of very intimate. And he was very open. He blessed everything, even every dishwasher and everybody. He was just wonderful.
Did the party end up in the kitchen like it usually does? Pope just hanging out?
No. But when I got to tell you, I have a 93-year-old mother. So I came home and I said, I cook for the Pope. And she said, who next? And she stretched her hands and looked up in the sky. I says, I'm not ready for that yet.
No, not for a while. Well, Lydia, thanks so much for telling our audience how to behave.
Oh, my pleasure.
And now, time to eavesdrop.
Eddie Wong is the restaurateur behind New York's popular bun shop, Bauhaus. He also hosts the Vice TV series called Fresh Off the Boat. It's an irreverent take on food and assimilation, much like his recent memoir. Today we overhear him read an excerpt.
Yo, what up? This is your boy, Eddie Wong. This chapter is about the first time a white kid invited me to stay over at his crib. I had to ask my mom for permission to go over to Jeff's house.
What do his parents do?
Doctors.
What kind?
Anesthetic? I have not heard of this. Jeff says he gives shots to people so they fall asleep before surgery. After calling several of her sisters and friends, she figured it was a good job and improved.
Okay, good job. You make a good friend.
My mom was pretty proud of herself. Her plan to have me rub elbows with the children of rich kids was working. When the day finally came, my mom dropped me off.
Hi, I'm Jessica. Are you Jeff's mom?
Yes, I'm Mrs. Miller, and you must be Eddie. It's so nice to meet you. Jeff talks about you every day. Hey, Jeff. Hey, man. Jeff, go on ahead and take Eddie upstairs. You boys can play video games. We ran upstairs, but I could hear my mom from downstairs.
Thank you so much for having Eddie over. He says your husband is a, anesthetics.
You must mean anesthesiologist.
Yes. He gives the shot, right?
Well, yeah. He gives people shots or treatment before they go into surgery.
Ah, like the Novocaine. I get it all the time at the dentist.
That's fantastic.
Great. Well, I will see you tomorrow. We pick up Eddie around 3.
I walked up to Jeff's room. I couldn't believe my eyes. Toys, games, huge television, stuffed animals. It's like living in a Toys R Us. I remember thinking to myself that if I died, I wanted to come back a white man. I literally rolled around in video games, looked at all the GamePro magazines, and then went to the bathroom and wiped with their fancy toilet paper just to see how it felt. When you washed your hands, they had hand towels, so you didn't have to wipe your face with the towel your brother wiped his with 10 minutes ago. I felt like some wild gremlin child living in Chinese hell after going to their house. By that point, I was ready to convert. But then dinner happened. Jeff's mom came out of the kitchen with two bowls. One bowl was filled with goopy orange stuff. I thought they might be little boiled intestines in an orange sauce, which I could get down with. But on closer inspection, they were unlike any intestines I'd ever seen. The other bowl was gray and filled with a fibrous material mixed with bits of celery. I thought to myself, these white people really like mushy food. Jeff started wiping the gray stuff on the bread. Jeff and his brothers couldn't get enough, but I was scared. Holy that smell. I took a deep breath, clutched my orange juice, and forced myself to take a bite. Right on cue, gag reflex, boom went to orange juice. I couldn't hide it anymore. What is that, man? You never had tuna fish sandwiches? No, never. Where'd you get it? At the grocery store. You want to see the can? Okay, but what's the orange stuff? macaroni and cheese. It's pasta. I didn't know what pasta was, but was really starting to feel like a dumbass, so I didn't ask. That stuff was so nasty. We never ate cheese and it stunk like feet. I suddenly realized that converting to white wouldn't be so easy. But still, that toilet paper was like silk. I tried to force myself to eat the macaroni and cheese. It came through my nose. I realized no matter how many toys they had, I couldn't cross over. I'd much rather eat Chinese food and split the one good dinosaur with my brother. Macaroni is to Chinaman as water is to gremlins, teeth are to soup, and Asian is to American. It just didn't fit.
Eddie Wong reading from his memoir, Fresh Off the Boat. His Taiwanese Chinese restaurant is called Bao House, and you're listening to The Dinner Party Download from American Public Media.
And now it's time for another main course, one of our lessons about what's going on in the world of food.
Enrico, this story isn't about food per se, but it will certainly enhance all of the other food-related stories on our show because it is about salt.
That's right. Let's hope it also does not raise the blood pressure of the show.
Right. But it might raise eyebrows because this salt is farmed on top of a skyscraper in Midtown Manhattan.
Yes.
The woman who runs the farm is Sarah Sprawl. One afternoon, I took the elevator up to her salt kingdom in the sky. And when I met with her, I asked the obvious question. If you make salt for a living, does that mean you're always thirsty?
I am thirsty all the time. I've done many salt tastings where at the end of it, I'm about to collapse. But I don't make a habit of it.
All right. Let's tell everyone where we are. I'm staring at the top of Madison Square Garden and the Empire State Building. This isn't your traditional salt farm.
No, it's not. It's actually the first ever rooftop salt farm in the world, as far as I know.
So what gave you the idea to create it here and what made this space the right space?
Well, back in January, I was doing cooking demos for the Union Square Green Market, and I was so proud of every ingredient and the dishes that I would cook because I knew everyone involved in each ingredient. And then I would finish the dish with salt from any store on the corner. And I just thought that there should be more thought put into it. So it started as a hobby and snowballed into a salt house, which is an 8x12 house with evaporation trays. And
But how did you end up on a roof in Midtown? It doesn't feel very farmy up here.
It doesn't, but there's a lot of rooftop farm culture in Brooklyn, and I just thought that the city was kind of behind the time. So I decided to kind of find people that I knew with rooftop space.
And you need to be outside because sun is the key ingredient, right? So tell us, how is salt made?
So the one and only ingredient in our salt is Atlantic Ocean water. We have local fishermen that go 30 miles off the coast of Montauk to fish. And while they're fishing, they gather the water, which we bring up to the rooftop, filter, and evaporate in our salt house.
Is 30 miles enough? I mean, it seems kind of scary to drink water from the Atlantic Ocean right outside New York.
Right. There's actually zoning of where you can fish shellfish and, let's say, cod or tuna, and we only gather waters from those areas.
So what makes a salt distinct from one another salt? I mean, I've seen bigger crystals, smaller crystals, some taste saltier than others, but is there a larger spectrum of flavors that I'm not thinking about?
There is, and it actually is all about, people use the word terroir in wines, and I think it goes the same way with salt. It's definitely about the mineral deposits in the sand, what fish grow in that habitat. We would get gray salt from up north, and then we get a more pure, larger crystal salt from the Atlantic. It also depends on the weather, if it's rained or not, and also the season that we evaporate in. In winter, the evaporation goes quicker because the humidity is lower, so the crystals are smaller.
So show me around the salt house, please.
We have four holding tanks that are 55 gallons each. We filter the water into these tanks and let it settle for about 3 to 4 days.
And what do you filter the water with?
With a micron bag. So it's an all-natural bag that we pour the water through. It just takes out like any debris, which is not anything really at all.
You ever find a finger or anything like that?
Never found a finger, but I'm sure we would if we made like Hudson River salt or something.
All right, so you filter out the kind of debris, and then?
And then I let it settle for about 3 to 4 days. We empty the water, we filter it again into buckets, and then bring it into the salt house.
So this looks like a mini greenhouse.
With a wraparound porch.
Yes, with a wraparound porch that we're walking on. All right. Wow. And then in here.
So there's a lot of humidity going on, which is why we keep the roof vents open. But these are 500 bins with water in each of them.
We're looking at two, there's two rows of shelves, and there's lots and lots of these plastic trays with about, how much water is in here when you fill them up?
64 ounces of water. This has evaporated a lot. I loaded them about 3 weeks ago. So there's about 250 gallons of water evaporating here.
And so then you have a little table here at the end, and I guess this is where you do the salt sorting. What's the next step? Let's say one of these trays was filled with salt.
Okay, so we harvest the salt, and then we're going to actually have a drying rack, just a small drying rack in the corner right here. And then that'll sunbake for about a day. And then we're going to take that salt, sort it on our little workbench over here, and then package it up.
Can I taste some of it? What is the profile of your salt flavor versus something? Because I know they make salt in the Oregon coast and parts of California.
So the Atlantic Ocean is one of the saltiest oceans in the world, which works to my advantage because I get more out of a gallon than other people do, which is awesome.
Okay, and so the flavor profile is?
The saltier salt than you get from the Pacific Ocean. I think it's really clean. Here, you can put out your hand. You can see the natural crystal structure.
It's beautiful. Yeah, they look like jewels.
So it's a bigger crystal structure, definitely. It's got a nice crunch. And then at the end, it's just like a nice buttery, clean finish.
So we're up here, and it's really cool. But do you ever fear that you're surrounded by trays of crystal. You're in a little building on the roof that ATF is going to come in here and kick the doors down?
I have a story for you. The other night, there was a fire, I think, in the basement, and they had to check everything. So the fire department and police come up here and ask, what is all this stuff in this greenhouse up here? And actually, there's a gentleman that lives like one floor down, and he says, it's sea salt. And the guy's like, it's not sea salt. So they eventually make the policeman taste it, and nothing happened. I mean, he said it was fine, so.
Now he's your newest customer.
Exactly.
Enrico, now that Breaking Bad is off the air, I think the heat's going to die down a bit on Sarah's operation in the sky there.
She should still avoid short-brimmed black hats for a little while, though.
They would blow off anyway up there.
Oh, well, that's true.
Yeah.
All right, folks, coming up, the final few entrees on the menu for this, our annual all-food episode, including celebrated food writer Michael Pollan and a dessert recipe from Brit Rock superstars the Arctic Monkeys, for real, when the Dinner Party Download continues. Welcome back to the Dinner Party Download, the show that helps you win your dinner parties. I'm Rico Galliano.
I'm Brendan Francis Noonan, and you're listening to our annual post-Thanksgiving all-food episode.
Yeah.
It's a smorgasbord of some of our favorite food-centric segments from past episodes, and since it's 100% sound waves, it contains zero calories.
That's so nice. And it also nourishes your soul and brain.
And it makes you beautiful.
And other stuff. Coming up, Brendan's interview with the celebrated food writer Michael Pollan. But first, here's a chat I had with filmmaker Yung Chang about fruit and the people who love it.
And by love, you mean totally obsessed with it.
A little bit, yes. Yung directed the documentary The Fruit Hunters. It's about people who travel to the very far reaches of the earth to taste exotic fruit, or they dedicate their whole lives basically to preserving or collecting rare fruit. When we spoke, I first asked Yung whether he himself was a fruit addict.
You know, I didn't start out as an addict. I started out as a lover of certain types of fruit. I'm of a Chinese origin background, so I used to go to Taiwan a lot in the summers, and we'd indulge in some weird kind of fruit, like the durian fruit, for example.
Sure, known to be very smelly but very buttery inside.
The stinkiest fruit in the world. They say that it's like, it tastes like eating your favorite ice cream while sitting on the toilet. And as I started to realize that there were actual fruit-obsessed individuals, fruit hunters out there, and even organizations like the Rare Fruit Council International,
yeah.
That I started to realize, you know, this is serious business for some people. And then when you start filming it and people are showing you some of these incredible, almost like sculptural species.
Yeah. They look like they're from a different world, some of them.
Yeah, and you really get the sense that you want to forget about filming it and become more of a fruit hunter. And I think that obsession kind of took over as I was making the movie.
Well, let me ask, why fruit, though? Why not vegetables, which also can be in bizarre forms, or grains or something? What is the allure of fruit to these people and to you?
Yeah, I think the allure is when you think about, let's say, for example, broccoli or cauliflower, it doesn't really get you turned on. And the beauty of fruit is that they've been created to seduce us. That is the purpose of fruit, solely to make us want to eat it.
And I'm assuming the reason why biologically that, I guess, plants would want, if we can attribute want to plants, the reason why they want us to eat their fruit is so that we'll pass it through our systems and the seeds get out into the world.
Right. On the most basic level, yes, that was the initial intention of fruit, was so that we could spread their seed. And sorry, it just sounds very sexual because in a way it really is.
Early in the film, you show what looks like a mango auction. Was it only mangoes? It's an auction of some kind.
That is a very special annual charity auction that happens at the Fairchild Botanic Garden in Miami. Every year they have a mango festival. One of the highlights is this amazing mango auction.
Well, it looks like at one point a mango goes for $750. Is that for one mango?
That is for a handful of mangoes. Not a lot, but they are so rare and so special that people will bid top dollar for something like this. And, you know, I was there, spent some time there. People, you know, it's sort of unbelievable. I've tried mangoes that taste like creme brulee, pina colada, lemon meringue pie. I kid you not. It's a very, you know, it was an eye-opening experience to know there's so much more out there.
Well, this film is packed with shots of weird fruit, you know, non-mango fruit, and delightful little origin tales of various fruits. You mind if we run through a sampler of a few of these?
Yeah, let's do it.
So the first thing is the miracle berry. That just blew my mind.
Probably one of the most fascinating and most unusual fruits out there. It originally comes from Cameroon. You eat it, and it doesn't taste like much. But when you combine it with food that is very sour, for example, lemons, there's a special trait in the miracle fruit that will convert that flavor into an extreme, almost saccharine sweet. So lemons will taste like lemonade, and strawberries will be the sweetest strawberry you've ever eaten. When we were traveling with the film, we came up with this great concoction. When you have, for example, a mojito, you can have this mojito without the sugar, but eat a miracle fruit beforehand. It'll be the best mojito you'll ever have.
Really?
It tricks the taste buds in your tongue to register the whatever is sour or bitter as sweet.
Let's go on to the discovery of the Macintosh apple.
That is a love story. The story of John Macintosh, who was an American who left the U.S. during the Civil War in search of his wife, who had left beforehand, and near Cornwall, Ontario. It turned out his wife had passed away, and looking up, he saw this lone sole apple in a tree where his wife was buried. And that apple became known as the Macintosh apple.
And I think of a Macintosh apple as being a little bittersweet, so it's kind of perfect.
Yeah.
One guy in the film mentions in passing that fruits run the gamut from wonderful to scary. tell me about a scary fruit.
Yeah, there's a lot of scary fruit out there, and especially in Borneo. We discovered a fruit that is called the snake fruit. It's also called selak, S-E-L-A-K. And it kind of looks like an onion, but coated in a leathery skin.
Perfect.
And that skin resembles reptilian, you know, sheath of reptilian skin.
Isn't this thing supposed to be tempting? That doesn't sound like something I'm going to go, hey, let's put that in my mouth.
Yeah, exactly. It's not tempting for everyone. But then when you slide this skin off, there's these cloves in the interior, and they are crispy and delicious.
Wow.
So it's scary at first, but then there's some sort of allure, you know. I think there is something about fruit being like that, where you kind of sometimes you're in shock and awe at its appearance, but upon tasting it, it can be transcendental,
like love itself, scary,
like love
worth sticking around for somehow. Mr. Chang, thank you so much for teaching us today.
Thanks so much. It's been great speaking with you.
Filmmaker Young Chang. You can stream his new documentary, The Fruit Hunters, online. We've got a link at our website, dinnerpartydownload.org.
And Brendan, speaking of scary fruit, Young also told me about his favorite weird example of fruit.
Okay.
He said it looks like eyeballs growing out of a tree's bark. That's for real.
It's discovered by Salvador Dali, right?
I think it was. Yeah. Probably.
And now we turn from fruit hunter to truth seeker.
All right.
Perhaps no one has done more to raise awareness about what Americans put in their bellies than nonfiction writer Michael Pollan.
Sure.
Starting with his best-selling book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, he has lucidly explained the way we grow, cook, and eat our food.
And in some ways, I wish he hadn't, because now I have no excuse for eating Cool Ranch Doritos and hot dogs.
But you still do anyway.
On rare occasion, I sprinkle the crushed Doritos on top like relish.
Maybe he'll write a book on that. That'd be pretty good.
It'd be a horror story.
But in the meantime, his latest book is called Cooked, in which he examines the art and history of cooking by setting out to learn how to cook, which sounds fascinating, but then it occurred to me, food writer Michael Pollan didn't already know how to cook?
I was a cook. I mean, we did cook, and we probably cooked more nights than we didn't, but I was a kind of careless cook, a thoughtless cook.
So you also suggest that cooking is essential to who we are as human beings. You quote James Boswell, right?
Yeah.
Humans are a cooking animal.
We're the cooking beast, yeah.
And then you link that up to a larger hypothesis, the cooking hypothesis.
Cooking turns out to have been very important to our evolution as a species, and that we would never have left the world of the apes if we hadn't mastered the power of fire.
Yeah.
And Richard Wrangham is an anthropologist and primatologist at Harvard who's put forward something called the cooking hypothesis. You know, there's always been this question among anthropologists, how did our brain suddenly get so big?
And you're talking biologically, like how did our brains grow
so
large?
It actually got large. What happened to us, if you compare us to an ape of the same size, we have a much larger brain and a much smaller gut. They have a lot more apparatus to digest food. And the reason they need that is because they're eating lots of raw food. And that is hard to digest. At some point, we figured out a way to get more nutrition from what we were eating, more energy. And that was cooking. And as we acquired this incredibly energy-dense diet, our evolution, natural selection, kind of reoriented our focus from the gut to the head. And that allowed us to do language and culture and all these wonderful things.
So you cleverly divide your book up based on the classic elements, right? Mm-hmm. There's fire, water, air
and earth. Yeah.
And so maybe we could just like hop through each of these and we can talk about one little fact.
So I started with fire. And fire is the first element of cooking. It may go back as much as 2 million years. And for fire cooking, I really looked at barbecue. I mean, what's the closest thing we have now to traditional fire cooking, which is to say whole animal, slow-burning wood fire, a lot of people hanging out, having a big party afterwards.
And you actually relate barbecue all the way back to kind of animal sacrifice.
Yeah, ritual sacrifice.
Well, so explain that link.
Well, it's really interesting when you look, you go back and you look at the Old Testament or the Greeks, and they both had ritual sacrifices of animals. They both kind of moved in the same direction. First, they were sacrificing people, and they said, let's just give them an animal, and this is it. And then they said, you know what? Let's just give them the smoke from the animal so we can eat the animal.
I thought that was a really beautiful thing. The gods can't consume meat, right?
Right.
So
somebody figured this out. They said, hey, if the gods don't need to eat meat, because if they eat meat, then they need to eliminate, and it raised all these theological issues. All they really want is the smoke, and that's the only way we can get it to them anyway. So let them have the smoke, and we eat the meat in a big party.
Okay, after fire, you move on to water. You learn how to cook with water using pots, and you talk about how the cooking pot is, quote, a second human stomach.
Yeah. Well, amazing things happen when humanity invents ceramic pottery. It's long after fire. It's not until about 10,000 years ago that we learn how to use clay, fire it, so that we can boil water in it. And when you can do that, there's all these other things you get to eat. You couldn't eat grain, for example, very well with a fire. You could toast grain, but that didn't really work.
Again,
as well
too much work to break down for our bodies.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. And grain is got nutrients locked up in these polymers, and they need a slow cook in water. I mean, think about oatmeal. And so this is a tremendous advance, because once you've got pots, you can use vegetables in really interesting ways.
And you talk about how the pot is also responsible for extending our human family, and that older people could eat food that was broken down in pots, and
exactly
infants
right.
could survive.
And infants. You could wean infants, because before this, you needed teeth to eat. And so you couldn't wean babies as early. But now that you can soften food and grain, you can keep old people alive longer, and that has a huge effect on society. And you can wean earlier and have more kids, and all sorts of interesting things happen. So it's a really key technology.
All right. So let's move on to the air section of the book, where you learn how to bake bread. Bread is 80% air. And you say at the beginning of this chapter that baking is, quote, the carpentry of the food world.
Yeah.
What did you mean by that?
Carpentry of cooking. I thought it was because I'm intimidated by carpentry. I'm a gardener where there's tons of margin of error, right?
Yeah.
You really can't screw up too badly in the garden. And I thought that's what baking was. It struck me as the rocket science also of cooking, and that you needed a scale calibrated in grams.
Yeah.
And if you didn't get everything just right, it
I
was
find it
collapse.
A little intimidating because of the,
I did too. I was terrified of baking, but it turns out it isn't really that way. Once you've done it a few times, you do it by the senses. I mean, you feel that your dough is billowy and has air in it, and you taste it, and you see it's getting a little sour, and you see how big it's gotten, and you really rely on your senses. So it's a lot more improvisational than I thought. That was a surprise.
All right. Well, the last section of your book is Earth, and you explore the world of fermentation. You make beer, you pickle cucumbers, and you also make cheese with Sister Noella Marcellino, a.k.a. the cheese nun.
Yeah.
She's a nun, microbiologist, and cheesemaker. And she says something really interesting. She suggests that cheese should be included in the Holy Eucharist.
It's interesting. The Eucharist is when you take communion, which I don't do as a Jew, but I've watched it done, you're basically working with fermented products. Bread, which stands for the flesh of Christ, mm-hmm. and the body of Christ, and wine, mm-hmm. Which stands for the blood. And it's very interesting. They're both fermented. Fermentation is a transcendence of the given into something and an elevation into something else. Mm-hmm. And she was saying, well, there's a third fermented food that belongs in there, and that is cheese. And I said, why? I said, well, cheese is about the dark side of life. It reminds us of our mortality.
So what does she mean by that?
Well, it's a lot like flesh.
All right, the texture of cheese.
It lives and dies. It smells. Mm. It is about decay. You know, talk about dust to dust. It's the rot of animal flesh in a way. And I sort of didn't see it, but I think she's saying you either add that or swap out the bread. Hmm. And that this is a wonderful symbol of the human body.
So I'm sure now you carry all this information with you after your research. I'm wondering, do you carry anything with you from before your research? Like, does Michael Pollan still have a guilty pleasure? Does he still Cool Ranch Doritos? There's not one kind of modern
I like Cracker pleasure. Jacks, actually. That's okay. One of my favorite junk foods, which is caramelized popcorn. I mean, I think I would say the prices have gone way downhill. they're just paper now. You know, you used to get a toy.
Yeah. So. This explains that fake tattoo on your hand right now.
Good one. That's an old radio trick.
So, Rico, Michael recently made cheese with another microbiologist.
Okay, not the cheese nun.
Not the cheese nun. This woman's name is Christina Agapakis, and she teamed up with artist Cecil Tolas, and they made cheese using microbes found in Michael Pollan's belly button.
What?
That's
Why?
Right. That body fromage is currently on display at the Science Gallery at Trinity College in London, and I can see your face. Don't worry, it's not being offered as food.
Even so, that's not right. Okay, we've almost reached the end of our audio meal, thank God.
It's an all-food episode, but not an all-you-can-eat episode.
Alas, so we're going to leave you appropriately with something sweet. And it is courtesy of Brit Rocker's Arctic Monkeys. This past September, they released AM, the band's fifth consecutive number one album in the UK. They're touring in support of it in December.
They told us a few tunes to spin at a dinner party. One in particular inspired more talk about cooking than music.
Hello there. This is Alex. I'm with Matt.
Hello.
And we are both one half of the Arctic Monkeys.
So for the third song in the dinner party, we're going to play Joe Cocker, Woman to Woman. I think it naturally takes us to dessert, which will be a chocolate self-saucing pudding. The way you make this pudding is interesting. As interesting as song choice.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're probably thinking, how do they get that chocolate sauce in there when it's surrounded by cake? You have to create sort of a chocolate ice cube, melt the chocolate, then freeze it in a cube tray, put your cake mix around it, cook it, your sauce is in there and it's not escaping. Woman to woman, everything I say, just label them as supper. In England, pudding just means dessert a lot of time. Like,
right.
Do you want any pudding? That means do you want any dessert? So it's not just the little pots that you put in a fridge and eat at school. Woman, woman, woman to
woman. Honey. I'm sorry. I was just going to try and sing pudding. Pudding. Dun, dun, dun. Pudding. Dun, dun, dun. Kind of, you can imagine, like, that spoon going into the thing. It's coming out. Okay. Who would you like to invite if you could invite anyone, like, you know?
David Beckham.
Dead or alive.
And if we can do dead, I'd probably bring a stegosaurus. From the bottom of your heart.
Alex Turner and Matt Helders of Brit band Arctic Monkeys. Their album's called AM, and they launch a North American tour in December.
And that concludes this year's gluten-full, hormone-added, preservative-laden, all-food episode of the Dinner Party Download. Mm. We'll be back next week with an all-new episode featuring Oscar Isaac, star of the new Coen Brothers film Inside Llewyn Davis. Till then, keep up with us on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is DinnerPartyDNLD.
Thanks to our sous chef, Jackson Musker. Our line cooks are James Delahousie, Davy Kim, and Brittany Martin. Our fry cook engineer was Chris Clark, and our maitre d' is Peter Clowney.
Thanks for listening, and bon appetit.